This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm Jason Shulman. We've got a great show for you today. My guest is Josh Lambert, Academic Director of the Yiddish Book Center, who also teaches at UMass Amherst. Here to talk about his new book, Unclean Lips, Obscenity, Jews, and American Culture, published in 2014 by New York University Press. Josh, welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies.
Thanks, Jason. Great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. So, Josh, maybe you can begin by telling us briefly what is obscenity? And given that you're an expert in literature, have obscene books been a big part of American history?
Well, obscenity is notoriously difficult to define, so we could spend a lot of time talking about it. For me, the definition that was relevant was the one that went into effect in American law in the late 19th century, after the sort of efforts of Anthony Comstock, who founded the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice. And basically what got enshrined in law through his efforts was a definition of obscenity that meant that books that had lewd or lascivious contents or used taboo language could not be mailed. There was also, as I discuss in the book, a separate issue connected with obscenity at that period, which was information about birth control and contraception. And I discuss that in the book. But the main sort of kind of obscenity that I'm interested in is the one that centers on descriptions of sex and the use of taboo language, the four-letter words that we all think of as indecent somehow.
Mm-hmm. Comstock is an interesting figure that appears in the introduction. Can you tell us a little bit about him? What were his motivations?
You know, he's been written about a lot and is a fascinating figure. The way that most of the people who've written about Comstock understand him is as representing a kind of Christian uneasiness with the changing circumstances of America at the time. And many of the scholars who have written about him have pointed out that so many of his victims were outsiders of one kind or another. And by victims, I mean the people that he chased after and tried to prosecute as purveyors of obscenity. Jews were one major category of people that he went after, but also women and other immigrants. And people have interpreted that, I think, quite rightly to say that to understand Comstock as having expressed this kind of anxiety about the way that the American population was changing and that the possibilities of what you could do as an American were sort of changing under his feet.
Right. It sounds like it's a little hard to, think about what life was like in the late 19th century. I mean, today we think of the internet, and everybody can sort of get whatever they want on there. Things were limited back then, and there was much more of a Christian morality.
Right. I mean, and I think there was an assumption, a fairly widespread assumption that Christian morality was the dominant one in America, and that was worth fighting for and protecting. Certainly, in some of Comstock's speeches, that commitment to Christian virtue came at the expense, rhetorically at least, of Jews who represented something else.
Right. So your book asks a question that, once you've posed it, it's so obvious. But the question is, why have so many Jews been involved with obscenity cases? So before we get into sort of why, has the question been asked before, or is it one that's not really, we don't really like to discuss?
Part of the reason that I started working on the project was precisely that there are so many excellent studies of obscenity in American culture by lawyers, by literary scholars, by historians of various kinds. And the evidence sort of piles up of Jews' involvement in the field. And yet in so many of those books, the only time the Jewishness of anyone involved gets mentioned is when it's unavoidable in a primary source, when someone mentions their own Jewishness. But those scholars who you know do excellent work, I think, were hesitant to address the question in the way that I do, because the connection of Jews with transgressive sexuality has been such a common trope in anti-Semitic discourse. And there's such a worry that by discussing it, you can play into anti-Semitic stereotypes. So for the most part, there hadn't been any kind of extensive or a full-length study of the question. There had been little pieces here and there, but nothing that took on the question, you know, at the length and with the intensity that I did, which was why it was worth doing, although even doing it in that way is a fairly complicated project.
Right. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about what were the roles that American Jews played in obscenity cases? You know, what professions did they hold that sort of predisposed them to get involved? And is there any sort of economic reason why Jews might have been involved in these particular cases?
Sure. I think that when we look through the case history, so I mean, just to give a sense of how I got into the topic as a literary scholar, I started to read back through legal histories to see, you know, what were the major cases? When did laws change about what you could write in a book or how you could talk about sex in American culture? And I started to find cases with names on them like Rosen and Roth and Cohen and Ginsburg. And those are names that obviously made me curious to see who those people were. In many of the cases, they were, you know, to give examples, Rosen was the Rosen in the 1890s, who became the subject of a Supreme Court case, was the editor of a magazine about theater, a sort of saucy Broadway magazine. The Ginsburg, who was a Supreme Court, you know, who has a Supreme Court case named after him, owned a newsstand on Long Island. Some of the people who got involved were producers of birth control materials or contraceptive devices. And of course, many publishers of erotica or obscenity, like Samuel Roth, who was the subject of a major case in the 1950s. There were also film exhibitors. I'm trying to think what else. Publishers, as I said, people in all the sort of intermediary fields in the distribution of culture. That's the role of Jews in all those kind of areas was, of course, what put them in the line of fire for obscenity prosecutions. But what fascinated me and is something that I haven't completely answered is not why they occasionally found themselves on the wrong side of obscenity law, but why Jews were so commonly the people who were willing to take a case all the way to the Supreme Court, right? Like not to just give up and stop appealing, pay whatever fines or serve whatever time and be done with it, but really to keep fighting these cases and by doing so, insert themselves into the larger legal history. I should also mention that Jews were extremely prominent as lawyers and judges in these cases. One of the things I like to always, an example I always like to use that compelled me as I started to look into the subject more was that in this key moment when obscenity law was being tested and articulated after World War I, the lawyers around the ACLU who had founded it were mostly Protestant, and they refused to take obscenity cases. They wanted to fight at that time against the suppression of political speech, and they thought obscenity would distract them from that cause. But there were a handful of Jewish lawyers who were associated with the ACLU, and those were the ones who took on the major obscenity cases of the 20s. So there was a case where I said to myself, there was a clear pattern where Jewish professionals were taking a different path than their non-Jewish peers in the same field.
Mm-hmm. And the involvement of Jews as, you know, litigants, lawyers, book publishers, judges, justices, you know, it kind of it goes on for so many decades that it would be hard to say, right, that their European background, you know, their experience with European censorship sort of, you know, made them favorable to free speech, right?
Right. I part of the argument of the book is that precisely that to ask the question of all the Jews in America is the wrong way to ask it, because as we move from the late 19th century into the book goes into the early 2000s, the circumstances change so much that the motivations of an individual very rarely fit the same pattern from one period to another one. So it's exactly right that I'm very skeptical of arguments, of essentializing arguments that suggest that something about the way that Jews experience European culture or experience immigration conclusively predetermined their responses to obscenity controversies. That seems wrong to me from the material that I look at. Even though in some specific cases, particular Jewish experiences are very, very important and become very useful to look at in understanding why a group of people or particular individuals acted the way they did around obscenity cases.
Right. Okay. So in the late 19th century, there is this sexual anti-Semitism, if I can call it that. Can you tell us a little bit about the ideas about sexual abnormality as they pertain to Jews? And maybe, you know, that'll lead us into the first chapter, which talks about the figure of Dreiser. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about him.
Sure. So when we look back to some of the foundational texts of modern anti-Semitism, like Edouard Drumont's La France Juive, you see in that text and then in the American text that adapted and mostly reproduced the claims that had been made in France, very explicit statements about Jews' sexual abnormality, statements about Jews being behind obscene publications, about Jews speaking in indecent and obscene ways, and then particularly a very pernicious set of claims around Jewish men's sexual abnormality. There were claims made by several fairly prominent anti-Semitic figures that Jewish men were predisposed to what we would now call pedophilia, to child molestation, and could not control their sexual urges. Theodore Dreiser, this major American author, one of the most prominent authors of the early 20th century, writes this play called The Hand of the Potter in about, I think it comes out in 1919, that takes as its inspiration a very famous national case that had happened a few years before, where a young Jewish man named Nathan Swartz had been accused of and sought for murdering a 14-year-old girl, and that case ended with him committing suicide and confessing the crime. Dreiser's play takes that as its inspiration and describes a young Jewish man who comes home from prison, finds that he can't control his urges, sees a young girl who is his neighbor and rapes and murders her and eventually commits suicide. It's a brutal play, very disturbing. Many of his contemporaries found it shocking and appalling. And in fact, H.L. Mencken told him that he should not publish it. He should just burn it. But what was a fascinating piece of that history is that Jewish literary intellectuals of the moment were precisely the ones who praised it and said it was an important work of art.
And then as we get later into the 20th century, you know, we talk about Nazism, and then we get to the sort of awkwardly written Robert Rimmer's The Harrod Experiment. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So that's a novel that I was fascinated to discover, a very popular best-selling mass-market sex utopia novel from the 60s. That's where the first chapter of my book climaxes, because what that chapter has been tracing, starting with Dreiser, is the notion that a free and open discussion of sexuality and representation of sexuality could somehow serve as a counter to anti-Semitism. So the reason that people like Ib Khan and Ludwig Lewison loved and appreciated Dreiser's play about a Jewish child molester was that what Dreiser was trying to accomplish there was to show that Jews were no more prone to that kind of behavior than anyone else. He was trying to import Freudian ideas about sexual pathology into American discussions of this kind of crime. Rimmer, writing about 50 years later, is looking at the possibilities for new sexual freedoms in the 60s, seeing them as incredibly exciting. He's particularly interested in what we call polyamory as a new form of social organization that could be very transformative. And fascinatingly, strangely, at the center of this novel, which it basically takes place on a college campus that has gone co-ed, and the rooming has become co-ed so that the students all have sex with each other and one another, and somehow that leads them into a kind of sexual utopian community. But what's amazing about that novel and very strange is that Rimmer includes a Jewish character among the group that he describes, and spends a lot of time, an almost absurd amount of time, focusing on that character's Jewish family and the sort of Yiddish words in his speech and his parents and how they feel about all this, where he doesn't do that for any of the other characters. And I was interested when I discovered that to try to figure out why on earth a Rimmer, who is writing a novel that, you know, is a fairly straightforward romanathèse about sexual freedom, would spend so much time on issues of Jewishness. And the answer that I found was partly personal. It was that Rimmer had been involved in a group marriage with a Jewish couple and had found those particular people very accepting and warm, and they were an important part of his life. But it was also the case that in the years after World War II, Americans were looking for ways to respond to the horrible genocide of the Holocaust and trying to find ways to understand how it had happened. And a lot of people, for various reasons, looked at diseased sexuality or prudish or repressed sexuality as at the source of that kind of violence. And so they felt, and Rimmer expresses this quite clearly, that once people could express themselves sexually, they wouldn't no longer need to act out in horrible acts of violence.
You say in the book that you consider a wide swath of texts. That is certainly not an exaggeration. Everything from modernist novels to graphic novels and everything in between. Maybe you can tell us briefly, who is Henry Roth? I think he may be sort of well known, but I'm not sure. And you know, the second chapter, which deals with Roth, highlights the power of words. Roth's book, Call It Sleep, is very much about language itself. So I'm curious to get your thoughts about how words themselves, you know, can have this perverse or dirty meaning.
Right. Roth is a fascinating figure. Many people should know and will know his incredible novel, Call It Sleep, which is widely thought to be one of the great American novels about immigration. Part of the impetus for the project as a whole was that novel, which is such a masterpiece and yet so strange and disturbing. It's about a young child who is really racked by guilt and shame about his own body and his own family, and led by his guilt to do something very terrible that almost ends up killing him. In that book, in that novel, there's a scene where the little boy is in cheder, in a sort of traditional Jewish education for children, and is learning the chapter of Isaiah where Isaiah says, I am a man of unclean lips. And that's, of course, where the title of my book comes from. The little boy putting that piece of traditional text together with what he's learned on the street and heard in his family thinks that Isaiah must be a man of unclean lips because he's said taboo words, because he said words like fuck and shit. And what David, the little boy in the novel, comes to feel is by saying these words himself, he's defiled himself and become unclean, and he needs to seek a kind of purification. What fascinated me about the novel was not just this sort of portrait, the psychological portrait of the child, but the fact that Roth used these words, these taboo words, in his novel. Many people know that James Joyce's Ulysses was banned for more than a decade in America because it included those words. And at the time that Roth was writing his book, which was his first novel, and he was writing it in a fairly strange situation. He had a very unpleasant childhood, was certainly not secure in any sense. It's astonishing to think that he would use the same words that had gotten one of the greatest artists in the world banned in America. It's perplexing to think that he thought he could somehow get away with it. And so what I argue in this chapter is that this shows us how much was at stake and how much the use of these kinds of transgressive words could indicate the seriousness of a project and could, in a sense, ennoble an artistic project and show that it had avant-garde aims. So Roth is really interesting in that case because even though his book was never banned, it did famously sort of fade from the public consciousness for 30 years and only returned and was republished as a paperback and celebrated in the 1960s after the laws of obscenity had changed. So it's a kind of fascinating case of a writer trying to use avant-garde strategies and doing it in such a way that it may have backfired. But I think by paying attention to the issue of obscenity in the novel, which people haven't done before, it helps us to understand the sort of strange publication history that Roth had.
You mentioned that in the late 19th century, ideas about obscenity were actually tied to ideas about reproduction and actual sexual practice. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the other Roth who appears predominantly in the book, Philip Roth from chapter 3, and the use of sexual allegory to describe dilemmas of cultural reproduction. What's going on there?
Right. I think people who come to read my book will often feel that there's surprisingly little Philip Roth in it. I think many people who hear about the subject think that it'll be mostly about Roth. What fascinates me about Roth's novel Portnoy's Complaint, which I hope many people will think of when they think of the question of Jews and obscenity, especially in American culture, is that the strategies he uses to talk about the relationship between Jews and non-Jews, and those strategies are very explicit descriptions of the sexual relationships between his Jewish protagonist and non-Jewish women, and also discussions of masturbation and other sexual practices, are fairly typical of Jewish literature from the late 19th century on. We can find many, many texts in which questions of assimilation, of cultural reproduction, of the relationship between Jewish and non-Jewish cultures are figured through the romantic or sexual relationships of different characters. This is true in Hebrew and Yiddish literature. It's true certainly in American Jewish literature and English as early as the 1880s and 1890s. Roth, of course, takes that idea that you tell the story of the relationship between Jews and non-Jews through the relationship of two people to its obscene extreme, right? Making it about the very bodily relationships between Jews and non-Jews. There's a scene in Portnoy's Complaint where Portnoy is having sex with a young woman that he calls the Pilgrim, old from an old American family, and she is giving him oral sex, and she is choking and can't bear the sort of size and presence of his physical body. And of course, this is a sort of classic scene, but I argue that it figures the bodily discomfort that that Roth was seeing a certain segment of Americans experiencing as Jews became more accepted and, you know, welcomed into different kinds of jobs and different kinds of institutions, that there was still a kind of nervousness and discomfort with Jewish bodies. That kind of allegory, which is somewhat disturbing and strange and off-putting, is fascinatingly extended in a novel that I love to have the opportunity to write about in this book, Adele Wiseman's Crackpot, which is a novel, a very frankly feminist novel about an obese Jewish prostitute in Winnipeg, whose sexual relationships, I argue, figure a very positive relationship towards Jewishness, but in a very transgressive and uncomfortable way.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, a few weeks ago, we had Mark Shapiro on the show talking about how the Orthodox Jews censor. His book starts with that sort of famous picture from the Yiddish newspapers with President Obama during the bin Laden raid. And Hillary Clinton, then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, has been, removed from the photo. So maybe you can tell us a little bit in Chapter 4 about the Yiddish censorship or Orthodox and traditional censorship. Does it sort of show the wide spectrum of the variety of Jewish experience?
What fascinates me about the censorship of sex within Jewish culture by Orthodox authorities or equally by Yiddish cultural authorities is the degree to which those kinds of censorship don't get government support. So it's very interesting that it's not that Jews aren't censorious people, that somehow Jews are less apt to want to censor or control the way that people talk about sex than anybody else. It's very important to think about the relationship of people to state power and the way they use state power to enforce those kinds of desires or feelings. So that we can point to many cases in which rabbis in America or elsewhere thought that a text was too much or disgusting or repulsive and told their followers or told anyone who would listen, oh, no one should read that text. That's terrible. The classic example that's pointed out is in the Shulchan Aruch, like one of the most authoritative rabbinic texts that there's ever been. It explicitly says that there's a particular poem that no one should ever read. And yet, if you go through and look for historical sources, you'll find that other rabbis or other Jewish communities ignore those kind of edicts and read whatever they want. And there's never been a real sense of Jews having the power to enforce those kinds of ideas about obscenity, except, of course, in the state of Israel, where, of course, Jewish courts frequently enforce obscenity laws. So what fascinated me about Orthodox attempts to control sexuality, as well as Yiddish cultural examples in America, was that they rely on ideas of modesty. They appeal to the modesty of their listeners and their audiences and ask them to self-censor, to avoid those things that are those texts or cultural representations that are offensive. And of course, appeals to modesty have a very complex interwoven relationship with ideas of obscenity. And what I spend a lot of time in Chapter 4 doing is showing how these kinds of modest ideas very frequently contain within them or reflect tendencies towards extreme or explicit sexuality I spend time, for instance, looking at a series of polemics written in the 1990s by Orthodox Jewish thinkers calling for modesty, recommending modesty, and yet doing it in ways that are as sexually explicit as just about any texts you can find. So it's a fascinating kind of double-edged sword to how modesty works. And I think it's a really important model for American culture to look at, especially after the 1960s, when basically American law got out of the business of controlling sexual expression, right? Since several legal decisions in the mid-60s and early 70s, it's very unusual for any American novelist to get in any trouble for any kind of representation of sex whatsoever. And yet, of course, that doesn't mean that no one's controlling the representation of sexuality. It just means that the terrain has shifted so that authors and publishers and readers are the ones who get to influence that rather than, say, postal workers or priests or government officials.
Mm-hmm. Well, Josh, we've taken up a lot of your time, so any parting thoughts you'd like to share? And what are you working on next?
Oh, thanks. I enjoyed all this time that I spent working on obscenity, and it seemed to me that part of the fascinating issue of the story was the role of Jewish publishers and the way that they influenced American culture. So a lot of the work I've been doing more recently is looking at Jewish publishers more broadly in America and how they represented Jewishness and how they were involved in various kinds of debates about other subjects, not obscenity so much as debates about how American culture should be regulated and what's fair and ethical in the field of literature and art.
Josh, that sounds like a great project. I want to thank you for being on the show today. The book is Unclean Lips, Obscenity, Jews, and American Culture, published in 2014 by NYU Press. The author is Josh Lambert. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.